There's a long tradition of music evoking specific images, pictures, and one of the greatest of all the practitioners of that tradition was Claude Debussy, who flourished in Paris in the last years of the 19th century and the early years of the 20th. And one of the practitioners of the music, Claude Debussy, is with me. I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air. My guest is Catherine Kautsky, professor of music at Lawrence University and author of the book Debussy's Paris, Piano Portraits of the Belle Epoque. Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you, Norman. It's a pleasure to be here.
What was it that made Debussy so original? He must have had some kind of inspiration leading into this originality.
I'm sure he did, although it's interesting that he came from a family with no education and was always sort of completely on his own individual path. But surely he grew up hearing, for instance, the music of Chopin in Paris. That's where Chopin had been living 50 years earlier. And that use of the piano with its pedaled sound and sounds all blurring together to some degree, not nearly to the degree that Debussy did, surely had an impact. And then, to his eternal regret, Richard Wagner had an enormous impact on him as well. His use of harmony and his blending of various mediums, the use of text, the use of music, the use of staging, that was something that Debussy, for the longest time, couldn't resist. He made great, you know, pilgrimages to hear Wagner's operas. And then, in the end, he turned it all overboard and said, no, the Germans don't have anything to teach us. It's only the French. But it took a while, and he had absorbed a lot by that then.
And he had a lot of company with his fellow French composers in that, too.
He did. There was a long-lasting animosity dating back to the Franco-Prussian War and certainly heading into World War I as well.
Another French phenomenon seems to have been, and going back all the way to the Baroque, if not further, colorful titles for pieces of music, and Debussy fell right into that tradition.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Bach doesn't name most of his pieces, but you look at Couperin, Rameau,
yes,
and suddenly you're looking at cuckoos and mysterious barricades and all sorts of interesting things. Yes, but with Debussy, I'd say it's more helpful than with any other composer I've ever encountered in that his titles tell us so much about what he was seeing and hearing at Paris at that time. So they provide a kind of social history of the entire epoch of the Belle Epoque and of the years before and after as well.
And that would include things ranging from fashions of the time, you know, what women in particular were wearing, the dances of the time, and Debussy kind of wraps it all together with this wonderful sort of subtlety and delicacy.
What people were reading, the nationalism that we talked about with the sort of anti-German sentiment, his last prelude, you hear the strains of Marseillaise, certainly the art that people were looking at, even the children's books that were in fashion at that time. Gollywog was a children's book. He's a sponge. He's absorbing it all. Archaeological digs, sculptures that appear in the Louvre, it's everything.
So his piece, Voile, is also evocative of specific things that were happening in Debussy's time.
Yeah, Voile is nice because it offers an opening into so many different avenues. If you look at the photo of Loie Fuller, you'll see that she's ensconced in veils. She was a dancer from the United States who emigrated to Paris and was much more successful there with her dances of veils. And the shape of those veils, the arabesques that they form, was sort of a fixation among poets and painters and Debussy as well. So he wrote a lot of pieces that are filled with arabesques as well as pieces titled arabesque. And if you look at the veils, you might think of this piece, The Maiden with the Flaxen Hair, that sounds like this. You hear that down motion answered right away by the up motion. All these curvaceous ideas, the Art Nouveau painters loved those. And Debussy loved them as well because they weren't straight lines. They didn't go to a logical end. Instead, they curved round and round. So here this piece, we think, is about Loie Fuller's veils. We don't know for sure because voile can mean sails too. But Loie Fuller choreographed several of Debussy's pieces. So we know that they knew each other and we know that she was sort of a star in popular theatrical venues in Paris at this time. So as you listen to the piece, you can think about that photo and the enormous kind of mystery that she ensconced herself with. And you hear it in the music as well, because Debussy chooses to build the whole piece around whole tone and pentatonic scales. So it starts like this. That's a whole tone scale, and later on you hear this. And that's a pentatonic scale. And one of the things that's so important about Debussy is that he's moving away from the tonal system that had sort of dominated the last two centuries of quote, classical music, right? And he's looking for alternatives, and he finds them all over the place. One place he finds them is in different kinds of scales and in sounds that evoke the gamelan. So we'll hear more of that in the next piece, but you hear it already here.
Wow, by Debussy. Well, as you say, Kathy, you can hear the pentatonic in there, which is reminiscent of Oriental themes, and then the whole tones, which may have more of a harking back to earlier times, maybe even, you know, ancient sounding music, which I gather was also a bit of an interest in French composers, Sophie and Debussy, and I suppose Ravel too. But also with this Orientalism, it seems to have been a major theme, not just in terms of Chinese music, but also Japan in particular seems to have been an interest of these French composers.
For sure. And actually, the term Orient at that time encompassed an enormous area, not just the area we think of now, but Northern Africa, Spain even, Southeast Asia. So when we talk about Orientalism and its impact on the painters and the poets and the composers, we're talking to some degree about colonialism as well, because those are the areas that that France was taking over as colonies. But to start out with Japan, yes. And if you look at the image that Debussy chose for the cover of La Mer, it's a Japanese print. So Japanese prints had arrived in Paris fairly recently at this point. Debussy wrote the next piece I'm going to play, Estampes, in 1903. And he was influenced both by those prints and also by the world expositions that had taken place in Paris. So especially the first one in 1889 that he saw, where he encountered a gamelan for the first time.
Indonesian instrument.
This symphony of gongs, orchestra of gongs. And in the piece you're going to hear next, you'll hear things like... You know, and you just hear those gongs being struck. You hear the percussive element, but also the pedal creates the kind of resonance that they have. And also the scales that he uses. Here again, he uses pentatonic scale. And he's trying to imitate the scales of the gamelan. So he was enormously influenced by those other cultures and by the kinds of both musical and visual cues he could take from them.
Back with more from Catherine Kautsky and the music of Claude Debussy in just a moment. This is University of the Air. My guest is Catherine Kautsky. We're talking about Claude Debussy and his music, and specifically the way he builds images through music.
So this piece, Estampes, the first one, first movement of the three, is called Pagode. So he'd been looking at he didn't ever travel to these places, but he'd been looking at pagodas at this world exposition, and you encounter pagodas all over in Japan and in China, but also in Cambodia and Thailand and Vietnam. So that's the first piece. The next piece is kind of interesting because it's called Soirée d'Engrenade.
So you mentioned the Spanish themes or influences.
Exactly.
Very strong with many French composers.
Yeah, and what's interesting here is that it's not just Spain in general, it's southern Spain. So Granada is where the Alhambra is. It's in southern Spain.
Influence.
Exactly. So here we're talking about Arab cultures, and that's, of course, what the French were also encountering when they went to Morocco and Tunisia and Algeria, the countries that they were taking over, essentially, as their sort of far-off satellites. So you can see so many paintings by people like Matisse and Renoir, and even before that, Delacroix, Jerome, where they're looking at the sights, the colors, the women, above all, of these far-off places. And they're looking with a kind of envy. And you'll hear in this second piece, which starts out already with this habanera rhythm, and then it's a very seductive tune. Right, very chromatic and somehow insinuating, and you can just imagine these beautiful women who they were encountering and who they found so available. So yes, this goes from one culture to another. The third piece is in a sense French because it makes use of two children's folk tunes, but even children for Debussy are kind of exotic. Mm-hmm. He writes a lot of music for and about children, and I think he envies their innocence and the way that they too seem to escape from the sort of the drudgery of daily life and live in a kind of fairy tale world, in a world of make-believe. And that's what all of this is, of course. He didn't really see pagodas. He didn't really see harems of women. And he wasn't a three-year-old child anymore, but he wished searched for all of those things. He said he lived among apparitions. And this piece, in a way, is a compendium of those apparitions.
So this would be Gardens in the Rain?
Yes, that's the third piece.
And you mentioned La Mer, of course, the sea. And I was going to say that water is another thing that Debussy just was fascinated by and so great at evoking in piano music.
Absolutely, and I think, again, because of the mystery, right? Because it's clear, and yet it distorts. It reflects light. It's always in motion. It has all these different kinds of energy. So, yeah, water was a perennial fascination. And, in fact, he said that if he hadn't been a musician, he would have been a sailor.
He actually wore, when he met the composer, Albéniz, the Spanish composer, came to visit Debussy. He didn't recognize Debussy because Debussy was dressed as a sailor.
Well, there you have it. And I think his father wanted him to be one, so he thwarted his father's ambitions, but he carried them with him.
So from a stop, which means a sort of an etching or engraving?
That's right. It means basically a print. Mm-hmm. And so the title is about Japanese prints.
So it would be Pagodas, and then Soiree in Granada, and then Gardens in the Rain.
Gardens in the Rain. That's right. All wonderful images.
Thank you.
Some very evocative writing there from Claude Debussy and his yes. Estop, those musical engravings
yes.
Taking us variously to pagodas, wherever mm-hmm. they may be in the Orient exactly, and to the Alhambra
yep.
in Spain, and then just now to the Gardens in the Rain. Another thread that seems to run not just through French music, but music of composers who have lived in Paris, such as Stravinsky and Petrushka, is this fascination with clowns and the Commedia dell'arte.
Yes.
How does that manifest itself in the writings of Debussy?
Yeah, I think that's such an interesting question. It's one of the questions that made me write the book, because Commedia dell'arte was always this mystery, like, who would care, right? all these characters with masks, but they cared so much. I think there were so many things about the Commedia, which, for those who don't know, was a group of itinerant Italian actors who pantomimed their way across Italy to different towns that eventually migrated to France and were actually much more successful in France than they were in Italy. And by the 19th century, they were a huge attraction in France. They were very famous people, mimes, who especially the one who played Pierrot. So I think they liked the fact, the composers liked the fact that there weren't words, right? Music doesn't have words, and it tells you a lot. So if you can express everything through pantomime, then you're coming close to that same sort of art. Also, I think they liked, especially with Pierrot, his fickleness, his changeability, the fact that you never knew quite who he was. So his face is covered in white powder. Most of them are covered in masks. And they're constantly transforming before you. At one moment, he's aggressive and he's sticking needles in a woman who's betrayed him. At another moment, he's sad and lovelorn and sort of a lost soul. And I think it's that changeability that appealed so much.
That even in the pieces you just played, the Estop, there was some changeability, some rapid changes,
yes.
stops and restarts.
Yes, without any connecting mm-hmm. tissue, right? And I think that's one of the characteristics of 20th century music altogether, not just Debussy, right? That you're trying to evoke a sort of a world of the subconscious rather than the conscious, right? Of the way our mind works internally, not the way we present it to the world.
I think that's why the French, including Debussy, were so fascinated by the writings of Edgar Allan Poe.
Yes. Absolutely, absolutely. And the story of Edgar Allan Poe's that I think is most evocative of what appealed to them maybe is the one that's about the perverted imp, the imp of the,
imp of the perverse.
It's called the imp of the perverse. Mm-hmm. But it's the story of somebody who does something that he knows is going to ruin him and he can't help himself. And so it's this sort of sense that we're inhabited by other voices, by other people, by desires that we have no control over. Of course, this is also the age of Freud.
Sure.
Right? And so I think that's what appealed about Poe, too. In his world, it was often a nightmare world. But it's a world of dreams. It's, again, a world of apparitions, things that wouldn't really happen but might happen inside your head.
This is University of the Air, back in a moment, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Listening to the music of Claude Debussy and hearing how Debussy can build pictures with music, and my guest is Catherine Kautsky. So if we look at this capriciousness that you find with these masked characters
yes.
in the Commedia dell'arte, how does that manifest itself in Debussy?
So the next piece I wanted to play for you is one of the etudes, which are among the last pieces he wrote. He didn't write that much during World War I. He lived until the war was almost over, but he wrote very little because he was suffering from cancer, but also because the war was so devastating for him. But he wrote a set of 12 etudes for the piano, which are among his greatest
these be
works.
Technical studies, then, isn't
yeah,
that what an etude
sort
implies?
Of. I mean, they're probably taken after Chopin's etudes, mm-hmm. but they're quite different from Chopin's etudes. And the one I'm going to play for you is a great example of that sort of fickleness, that it starts out in the most sort of lush, beautiful way. It's called Pour les arpèges composés, and you hear these beautiful arpeggios, and they just roll. And then all of a sudden in the middle you get the... It just feels like it has absolutely nothing to do with the other material.
It feels clown-like, then, though.
It's clown-like. Exactly. It's like he's suddenly at a circus. And then he recedes again, and he becomes the Debussy that we know and love. But the Debussy I know and love is actually this one who is capable of those amazing transitions without any preparation that somehow nevertheless seem to work, so they must mimic our minds.
So this is... called?
This is called Pour les arpèges composés. So it's an etude about arpeggios, which means you hear broken chords throughout, except when you go to the circus.
Yeah. Here we go. Pour
and even there, you hear a few of them, but they sound like they're strummed by guitars. They're not that sort of lush sound of the piano.
Bring on the arpège composé.
Okay. Thank you.
is an etude, not an étude. Well, it's written by Claude Debussy. That's something else entirely, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, it's still hard like an étude's supposed to be, but it's all camouflaged. Yeah.
A lot of color there.
Yeah.
How compatible is all of that kind of language, that originality, with text?
Well, I think that Debussy was extraordinarily sensitive to text, and I think it's especially notable since he didn't get any formal schooling. So he grew up in this household where his parents weren't well educated. He got farmed out a lot. He finally went to the conservatory starting at the age of 10, but he never got a real, certainly not a literary education. On the other hand, he's obviously incredibly sensitive to words. So his songs are among his greatest works. Certainly his opera, Pélléas et Mélisande, is one of the very greatest operas ever written. And if you read his letters, they're beautifully, beautifully written. So I think of him like Schumann, who's the other composer that I think of as enormously interested in words. And, of course, Schumann's father was a book publisher, so mm-hmm. no wonder, right? But with Debussy, it's even more remarkable. So, yes, very, very keyed into language.
And so have works by Debussy been put to text?
Well, he writes songs that put other people's words to text, and he actually did write a play, interestingly, an anarchist play at one point.
So popular at the time, I guess.
Right. So he tried his hand at writing himself. But in general, he wrote the text for a few songs, especially one sort of famous one at the very much at the end of his life about children who had been ruined by the war, who don't have houses anymore. But the piece I want to play last for you is a piece that incorporates lots of different texts. It's by a living composer, a woman named Jessica Crash, who lives in the Washington, D.C. area. And I actually asked her to write me a piece, sort of giving some sense of the 21st century, looking back at Debussy's harmonic language and also incorporating words. So she chose, and I said, oh, you could use this letter or that. But instead, she chose to take a collection of texts from all different places. Some of the quotes are from song texts. Some are from newspaper articles at the time. Some are from letters he wrote. But I think all in all, you get a real sense of, particularly of the sort of ambiguity that Debussy lived in. You know, the first quote she uses is, they don't see, from a song text, they don't seem to believe in their happiness. Right? So, yeah, maybe you could be happy, but you don't really believe you're happy. What does that mean?
Sounds very fin de siècle, doesn't it?
It does, doesn't it? And she uses quotes about moonlight. Debussy hated the sun. It was much too bright and glaring.
Well, one of his most famous pieces, Clair de Lune.
Right. That's right. And Pierrot, who's associated with Clair de Lune, is always associated with the moon and the Schoenberg Pierrot Lunaire, right?
Sure.
And the association of Lunaire with lunacy, right? The work.
Absolutely.
So you could go in so many different directions with these texts, but I think they're really evocative in the way she uses his sort of ambiguous harmonies along with these somewhat perplexing texts, I think tells you a lot about Debussy.
And this is called?
This is called Debussy Chez Moi. Chez moi, meaning
at
in French,
place.
At my place. Exactly. Yeah. They don't seem to believe in their happiness. And their song mixes with the moonlight. They don't seem to believe in their happiness. And their song mixes with the moonlight. the moon descends. And the moon descends on the temple that was. Didn't Pierrot shake his fist at the moon? Also puppets, heads of wood, stomachs of bran, marionettes. We have nothing to say to each other. We have nothing. So close are we to each other. My melancholy thoughts. Of fizzled fireworks, no longer want to stop mourning for trespassed Sundays. My soul dies from too much sun. My soul dies from too much sun. Music, don't you know, is a dream from which the veils have been lifted. His sounds and images turn in the evening air.
Catherine Kowski, it's been a pleasure having you on University of the Air.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure to be here.
I'm Norman Gilliland. I hope you'll join me next time around for University of the Air here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thank you. Mm-hmm.